There's often this sense, whether it's related to climate or just somehow finding our place in the world and our sense of belonging, of wishing sometimes we were like somebody else. Oh, if only I were.
Welcome to another episode of In This Climate, where we're really happy that you're you.
But in fact, it's the uniqueness and that each point of view brings and the diversity from the collective views that fills out into a quality of wholeness.
This is Leslie Davenport, who's written several books, the most recent being All the Feelings Under the Sun, How to Deal with Climate Change, which is a workbook meant to help young readers manage their anxiety and work toward making change. She's also a licensed psychotherapist.
But I'm really primarily working as a climate psychology educator and consultant.
Speaking of education, at IU's Environmental Resilience Institute, which alongside the media school supports this show, we think a lot about resilience, what it does mean, what it could mean, how we approach this space. And I'm increasingly interested in our understanding of emotional resilience as a facet of environmental resilience.
If you looked it up now, what emotional resilience is, what you would find and the way it's been used is the capacity to bounce back from a stressful event to kind of whatever your baseline was. The problem when we try and apply that to climate, of course, is that the baseline is constantly changing. And in fact, it's projected to continue to become more stressful. So this idea of going back, bouncing back, doesn't really make sense because we need to find ways to be able to be present with increasing levels of challenge and distress. So that's how I talk about emotional resiliency now, is growing the capacity, because there are ways to do this, to remain empathetic, clear-minded, and present in the face of increasing stresses and discomfort. Emotions are really valuable. They're, in this case with eco-anxiety, an indicator that, whoa, something's not right here. You know, we have all our thoughts about it, but it hits us at a more visceral level, a sense of unease. And so in working with emotions like this in the field of climate psychology, we can't and we wouldn't want to eliminate those it completely, because it is telling us something's not right. Maybe I can help do something about this. And honestly, climate psychology is still in its infancy. It's just emerging. Even many people within my own mental health field say, what's that? And the idea of feeling comfortable or competent, of having clients come in wanting to talk about the emotional landscape related to the changing climate, is uncomfortable for a lot of psychotherapists.
Last episode, we talked about how climate-related anxiety and grief are most often a rational response to the real existential threats we're facing. We also talked about the catharsis of sharing climate feelings with others and working together. But we didn't get too far into how we can address climate anxiety in therapy, because while it is reasonable to feel strong and challenging emotions in relation to our environment, those feelings can be really hard to work with. And trained climate-aware therapists like Leslie can help us process and develop the tools we need.
If a therapist is not very aware of the climate science, it would be easy to think that a client is catastrophizing, exaggerating, they're just prone to anxiety, prone to depression, and put way too much of the burden on the client versus what is such an important first step, which is validating what's being expressed and understanding the context in which this is happening. Because without that there, it's hard to move forward.
That context is a pretty complex thing. It involves all sorts of ecological and social systems that pull on the ambivalence within us. Here's a pretty common example of how this might play out.
like we all do, we head to the grocery store or the market, we're shopping for things, and we come across blueberries because we've heard, you know, healthy food, organic if possible. But, you know, we notice, oh, they've just been flown in from South America. Actually, they're wrapped in this plastic clam that is not recyclable. So suddenly we're stuck in this bind. You know, do we follow the desire and the need for healthy nutrition? Do we follow the desire and the need for a healthy planet? And in a moment like that, they're not aligned. And there's this tug and pull, which is kind of the essence of ambivalence. And what can happen is that it's so embedded in our culture, getting from one place to another, and, you know, ambivalence about the transportation system and the food system, and on and on it goes, without there being very easy or easily accessible alternatives. So there can be this constant tension, and it can be very wearing to the point where people psychologically, emotionally just kind of check out because it's too hard. It's too hard to sustain that kind of tension. And so it's very difficult to bolster engagement when it feels like you're constantly swimming against the current.
Absolutely. So, I mean, if somebody's in this position where they you know, they want to walk to work, but they live in a community where you have to drive everywhere, you know, this sort of thing, you know, from your perspective, what are the ways that people might be able to sort of reckon with that and try to, I guess, not only, you know, get through their days, you know, but also maybe make a little bit of change along the way?
Well, you know, I like to borrow from the 12-step model and remind everyone that it's progress, not perfection, especially when it comes to individuals doing their best to make efforts. There's not going to be every choice where we're doing it the way we wish we could or want to for any number of reasons. But it's always helpful to look at alternatives, even something like carpooling, you know, which reduces the number of cars on the road, or inquiring in certain instances whether working from home is an option. You know, anything that is a harm reduction model is helpful.
Another option is finding some way to be involved in larger systemic change.
If someone wanted to put solar panels on their home, that they're fortunate enough to own a home, that it's an option where they live, that they could afford to do it. There's lots of ifs in there already. And if they were successful, it benefits that household and then has a slightly larger impact. But if someone were to become involved in a community effort to build a solar farm of some kind that produced energy for the entire community, then everyone would benefit. It would be much more far-reaching. And it would also not, you know, there's much more of an equity possibility there versus the kind of privilege that's even, you know, needs to be in place for that first option to be possible.
At this midway point, let's check in. The work we do at In This Climate is deeply and without exception tied to land and the way it's stewarded and exploited. That's to say, it is always tied up in the history and presence of colonization and systems of oppression. To acknowledge that reality is never enough, but it can be a valuable practice. While ITC features sounds from many, many places, we would like to specifically acknowledge and to honor the Myanmaki, Lenape, Bodewadmik, and Sawanwa people as past, present, and future caretakers of the lands on which Indiana University Bloomington is located. These ancestral indigenous homelands and resources are the current home of the Environmental Resilience Institute. We encourage everyone to engage with contemporary communities, to learn the histories of this land, to look at who has and does not have access to its resources, and to examine your own place, abilities, and obligations within this process of reparative work. You can start by following the direct links to the community's websites shared by the IU First Nations Educational and Cultural Center in the section Land Acknowledgement. I'd also like to embed in this acknowledgement an explicit call for accountability. We at ITC have not always listened with the rigor and dedication necessary to effect justice. It is our responsibility to do that. While we commit to the practice of deepening liberatory work, we invite you to challenge us, to work with us, to grow in the direction of reparative media. With that always in mind, let's keep going. You may be noticing a theme here, and that is the significance of community and collaboration. Leslie says a community's resilience relies largely on the social capital it holds.
And so the idea is that when communities are looking at resiliency, let's say they've been impacted by some kind of an event, the more that people are already connected, they know where the person lives who may need help getting out of their home. If it's a rural area, they know where the person lives who may have a generator. There's already this network set up of support that can happen in all kinds of ways, emotionally as well as practically. And the studies they found is that the communities with high social capital in those ways fare much better even than the communities with more financial resources, because it is that person-to-person community connection that's just essential. But there's also a really interesting development in neurology and brain studies. We're used to thinking of the stress responses as the fight or flight or freeze. And now they're recognizing that we also have a social nervous system, that as mammals, this is like an evolutionary psychology thing, that we tend to seek other people out for reassurance, for comfort. And it's not just a reassuring word or a hug or a, you know, sharing a space, but that our nervous systems co-regulate, meaning that if one person is more calm and centered, the other person's nervous system, not even conscious to them, is aligning, is finding a resonance. And so it's also a really beautiful concrete way to say that self-care, that all those things we might do for ourselves to cope better, is also a social community effort because of how much we influence each other in these ways.
So we've touched on lots of ways to work with and channel our climate feelings, but a huge question remains. Why aren't we, as a society, doing more to protect what we love? The answer is in no way simple, and involves, as you might have come to expect, an interplay of social inequity and the composition of our brains.
One of the problems, especially with the ways that we are wired, again, as human beings, is that we tend to respond to threats that are immediately in front of us. And that goes, again, way back to outrunning the saber-toothed tiger and keeping ourselves alive. And with the CO2 emissions going into the air, so much of that we can't see, and the change is incredibly significant but incremental in ways that we're not feeling as constant reminders that this threat is real and it's happening now, unless there is an event that then gets, you know, tied together. And the same thing, you know, facts and data don't translate often as a personal concern. So it is a problem with engagement, because still for many people it feels like it's going to happen somewhere else, some other time, some other place. And it's, you know, no one likes to think about risk and loss and not feeling safe, but some people have circumstances that makes it psychologically easier to keep it at arm's length.
According to Leslie, it seems to be human nature to be more engaged and active when the danger hits closer to home. And this principle applies to place as well as time. So for young people, their, our home and time is quite affected, and climate change feels deeply present.
So it creates this dilemma, at least in me, where the youth shouldn't have to shoulder the burden, but they are in this unique position of perhaps being more aware, feeling the pressure more directly. And so in that sense, there's a lot we can learn by just providing, for one thing, providing a lot of room and validation and support for those voices coming forth and those efforts being made, but not to cheer it on from the background, to continue to form alliances. In fact, you know, my redefinition of things, I try and redefine advocacy work as not only political and civic, which I think is essential, not only happening in the streets, but that every single endeavor, you know, the field of medicine, the field of psychology, like we're talking about, the field of education, every endeavor needs to do a re-evaluation and a restructuring related to climate and sustainability. So, because, and I raise that because sometimes I hear people say, well, what can I do? I'm just a, you know, this person who has no power in one way or another. But I can't think of a person, a parent, a young person, a professional in whatever field that doesn't have something they need to be addressing. So, alliances and working together are just essential.
And we all have our skills. I can't think of a single skill that couldn't be applied. So something I'm thinking about a lot is the role of imagination, creativity in sort of, you know, making the changes necessary in managing the anxiety that we're experiencing. And it seems to me like young people have a real knack for this.
It's funny. One of the things I just was investing most of my time in prior to shifting it so strongly toward climate was helping adults re-engage their creative imagination. Partly because, again, I'm very interested in brain science, and it ignites a different part of our brain than the rational part, the part that's linear and analytical and cognitive, which is necessary and needed. But, you know, there's half of our brain that's sort of offline and dormant. And especially since we need to shift business as usual, how things are normally done, how we're used to conceptualizing them, to envision things beyond what we know now, that creativity and imagination is an absolutely essential tool. And you're right, it tends to get shut down the older we get. It's sort of like I was talking about with how we need to build resilience beyond what we've known. We need to keep stretching, including in those creative ways. Like, just let's entertain something that might seem more far-fetched, just to try it on, and not be dismissive initially. But it's, it's going to take some practice.
So here's to steady practice and allowing ourselves to imagine a world of more just and resilient relations. This has been another episode of In This Climate, a podcast production of the Environmental Resilience Institute and the Media School at Indiana University. Our hosts are Jim Shanahan and Gabe Filippelli, and I'm Emily Miles, the producer. Today's guest was Leslie Davenport. Next episode, we'll hear from Ashley Consolo, and here's a quick preview of what you can expect.
People's relationship to land and connection to land is central to then everything that unfolds from there. And when you look at a mental health perspective, you know, that if the land is well, people will say they feel well. If they're able to go out on the land, they feel mentally healthy, they feel connected, they feel strong. People would talk about feeling free, the weight of the world would be released, anxieties would dissipate, you would feel better, you'd feel more who you were. A number of people would use the phrase, they felt more human and more who they were meant to be. So then that means that even subtle alterations in your ability to access the land because of a change in climate or resource development or forced relocation or land dispossession can have, you know, large impacts on mental and emotional health.
Cannot wait to share this conversation with you. If you want to reach out, you can always do that via email and social media. The email is itcpod@iu.edu, and we're at This Climate Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also leave us a review on your podcast listening app. That would be really cool and helpful. So thank you for listening, and thanks in advance for the review. Catch you next time. Bye.